Good morning. This is Focus 580. My name is Jack Brighton. This is our morning call-in program. Glad you could tune in today. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll be talking about the meanings of nature, as in nature with a capital N. Our guest is Jennifer Price, a writer and historian and author of the book Flight Maps, Adventures with Nature in Modern America, recently published by Basic Books. I'll let her describe the capital N part as she does so wonderfully in her book, but the basic issue is, when we talk about nature in our social, economic, and political lives, when we watch nature on TV, when we work to conserve and consume nature as something out there, in addition to whatever else we're doing, we're also telling ourselves stories about who we are. In various times and places and among different generations and classes of people, those stories have changed, but I think our guest Jennifer Price would argue that many of our meanings of nature in modern times have led us away from connecting with nature as a continuum of which we are a part. The consequences of that disconnection have ranged from the ironic to the tragic, and Flight Maps is a collection of essays on subjects ranging from the cultural significance of plastic flamingos, a field guide to the American shopping mall, and the relevance of dead birds on hats in defining gender roles and in setting the course for the American conservation movement. I'll let Jennifer Price tell those stories as much as we have time for during this hour, and as we talk with her, you can join the conversation. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, if that makes it any easier to remember. Also, toll-free anywhere you hear us around Illinois, Indiana, parts of the other states where we reach, 800-222-9455. Again, within the 217 area code, 333-WILL. Elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. Jennifer Price, good morning.
Hi.
How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. How are you?
Thanks. And thanks for joining us. And I should mention that Jennifer Price is talking with us by phone in Los Angeles.
It's in Los Angeles. It's 9 o'clock where I am.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, right away, I wanted to say that you struck a chord with me in your introduction in pointing out that we want to save our souls from consumerism, from the sins and costs of modernity, but at the same time, we want to enjoy all of modern life's social and economic benefits fully. And I thought, yeah, that's me. You know, I want to embrace natural values, whatever that means, but I want to consume stuff. I mean, you know, I want to enjoy modern life.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems like that's been the tension that we've found ourselves in ever since we started this sort of economic life that we enjoy so much.
I think that's true, and I think you've sort of gotten right to the guts of the book, from the get-go, which is really the punchline of the book, which is that the book is really about this idea of nature that I think is really one of the most powerful ideas in American culture, and it's not really been thought about enough, and this idea that nature is sort of out there, and it's the counterweight to modern life. It's the opposite of modern life. It's going to sort of. There's a great Volvo commercial for the new four-wheel drive Volvo that says, "It is perhaps our most impressive safety advance ever, a Volvo that can save your soul," by Donald Sutherland. You know,
right.
It's very persuasive, and I think that's. That really encapsulates well this idea of nature that's this place that's going to save our souls. And what I argue, and I do it by looking at things like TV and The Nature Company, it's a book in which I say it's sort of a book in which Thoreau goes to the mall, is that this idea of nature as being out there is so appealing and is so wonderful in so many ways, and certainly an idea that I have found myself attached to. But it's not very helpful, and in fact, it's pretty counterproductive because what it does is it prevents us from thinking about the ways that we use nature in here. So it prevents us from thinking about the ways in which Volvo uses natural resources from all over the globe to make the four-wheel drive or, you know, the gasoline that we put in the four-wheel drive. So it's a nature, you know, it's an idea, just like you just said, that allows us to kind of have things both ways without feeling like we're hypocrites. In that, you know, we think of nature as out there, but it kind of allows us to consume as much as we want without really thinking about, you know, in very concrete terms, how we're consuming nature.
Yeah. There's a wonderful quote that you cite from Woody Allen. he says, he's at two with nature.
Uh-huh.
I think that's exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things I want to do in the book is break down. We tend to think of ourselves also because of this idea, I think, that nature is out there and you go to it. there are nature people, and then there are people who, you know, like Woody Allen says, are two with nature.
Right.
I think that's not true. We're all nature people.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that we all want to go swing with the orangutans. You know, it just means that we're all people. We make our lives out of nature. That's how we do it. You know, we use nature to create modern life. And so that's what I really want to emphasize. I think this... you know, I'm certainly not the first to point this out. There's a lot of, you know, social ecologists. There are a lot of leftist critiques of the environmental movement. And I think what I want to do as a kind of nature person myself and as a person who long identified myself as a kind of nature girl is to say, well, yes, but at the same time, the reasons that we love nature and the reasons we find this idea of nature so appealing are not just hypocritical, but in fact we bring real anxieties and real desires about modern life to this idea, and you have to take those seriously.
Well, the book has five, essentially, they're essays, and they're I have to say that I am just... Really, I think it's marvelous writing, and it's funny, and it's sad. I laughed, I cried, and it's just great writing. And it's actually, I found myself laughing at some of the things, even though, you know, we're describing like the extinction of passenger pigeons and so forth like that. And I wanted to actually maybe start there, because I know we won't get to everything in the book, and I hope that people will be encouraged to read it, because I think it's full of wonderful insights. The passenger pigeon episode says certain things which kind of get to the core of our constructions of nature and the way that we construct our own identities around that. Maybe, you know, just to start there, you were looking for the meaning of the passenger pigeon. You did some historical research. Mm-hmm. The meaning of the passenger pigeon before, during, and after its passing.
Yes, and I mean, first let me say I'm really glad you laughed, because nature writing is notorious for having no sense of humor, and that's one of the things I wanted to do with this book, is show how you could laugh and write about nature at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just say a little bit about the passenger pigeon, because a lot of people don't, I certainly didn't know really much about it before I started researching it. It was one of the great wonders of the world. It was this bird that traveled in flocks of billions of birds, and if you can imagine what that looked like or sounded like or felt like, it's just remarkable to read the accounts. They would darken the sky for hours at a time, and they would it was so noisy that you couldn't hear the sound of your own shotgun, and they would nest over these areas of, you know, 70 square miles so thickly that 100-year-old trees would keel over under the weight. And you have to remember that an individual passenger pigeon weighed about 9 ounces. So it was really this phenomenon of nature. And it was also a very, very tasty bird, as a lot of pigeons are. And it was shot intensively. And by the time you got these sort of transcontinental markets going in the late 1800s, it was shot in such quantities that essentially it was driven to extinction in one decade, pretty much between 1870 and 1880. And by 1914, the last one dies. Her name is Martha in the Cincinnati Zoo.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, that's the story, just for background. What I do is that this happened right before modern conservation was ready to erupt. It was a time when Americans were basically destroying the environment at a remarkably rapid pace. And the passenger pigeon extinction quickly became this kind of dark moral, you know, moralistic tale about what we did wrong. And the answer was always the same. It was always the market hunters did it, and they were greedy people, so we can't be greedy. And what I do is I go back and I look at the story and I say, well, maybe that's true. You know, there are lots of reasons to shoot birds for market, and not all of them are greedy. But what about the people who were eating the birds, you know, on the other end of the sort of the railroad lines? And what happened is, they were shooting them in the Midwest, and then they were shipping them by the millions to places like New York and Boston, where game was a delicacy. So you had people in these remarkable restaurants like Delmonico's, kind of the great restaurant of the late 19th century in New York, who were eating these phenomenally complicated pigeon dishes that took, you know, days to make. And I said, well, look at this person who's eating this pigeon. Okay, what does a pigeon mean to them? Well, it means something to them. It means something about, you know, their own wealth and all the things that eating in a restaurant like Delmonico's means to these sort of upper-class New Yorkers. but it doesn't really mean anything about pigeons. It doesn't really tell them anything about the flocks. They don't necessarily know anything about the flocks. They don't know about pigeon natural history. A lot of these dishes are so complicated, they might not even know they're eating pigeons. So I use the pigeon as a different kind of moralistic tale to look at people who are much more like me and much more like most of us who don't kill our own food and don't sell it for market but who consume in the cities and say, look what's happened. This is a kind of moment in which you can see people becoming modern. They're losing track of their connections to nature. They're drawing nature into their lives. You know, they're drawing much more nature into their lives than we ever have, but they're losing track of what nature is and how they're using it.
Whereas the people,
kind of a long explanation.
Yeah, no, that's fine. We like long explanations. This is public broadcasting.
Okay.
We dare to be dull. On the other end of the spectrum, the people who were actually killing the pigeons, and of course, initially it seemed like everyone was killing pigeons. All you had to do, you write about, you know, you could kill them with a stick, you know, just stick it up in the air,
yes,
and they would drop. And you know, the cities had to pass ordinances so people wouldn't go out and kill pigeons during work. I mean, there were so many of them.
Yeah, and I have to say, one of the things that the other things I do at the story is look at that end, at how, you know, what pigeons mean to people who are actually killing them, because I think in modern America, what's happened, especially among people who are environmentalists, is we tend to think of any kind of use of nature as being destruction. And I try to rethink that and say, no, we have to use nature. It's how we use nature. And I look at how these people are using nature. And on one hand, they're not using nature sustainably, and you know, by any sense of the word. You're right, you could shoot your rifle into the air, and as many as, sometimes you hear stories, or you read about stories of 60 or 70 pigeons would fall out of the sky, but at least 5 or 6. You know, this is, so people would go out, and it was kind of like a soccer finals in a Central American country. People would just drop whatever they were doing. The whole town would shut down. And people would go out and shoot pigeons. And it was kind of this festival time. And it was actually this really important time for people when they got together and they sort of understood, you know, how their community was sort of put together. And they all went out and they shot pigeons and they all ate pigeon pie. And it was this kind of festival time. And so on one hand, they were destroying pigeons. That's true. On the other hand, the pigeons were quite meaningful to them. And I think that that one of the things that we lost when we lost the pigeons was not just, you know, this incredible species, but human interactions with this incredible species and what pigeons really meant to people, which was quite a lot.
Yeah. Well, in these pigeon years, as you described them, they didn't come every year. You know, these huge flocks wouldn't necessarily predict where they were going to turn up.
Yeah, these flocks would follow the biggest crops of nuts, like oaks and beech nuts. And generally, a forest will produce a really huge crop of one of those, maybe once every 7 years. So the pigeons would show up, the flocks would show up near any one town, maybe once every 7 years, sometimes more often. And they would call these, in a lot of towns, they called these pigeon years. You know, these were the years that the pigeons showed up.
Mm-hmm. And the appearance of these huge clouds darting the sky of the pigeons. You write that the wild pigeons fueled the widely shared conviction that Americans would never deplete their resources. At least that's what it seemed at first.
Yeah, we forget that we live in a completely depopulated landscape, defaunated, you know, with just a fraction of the animals and the numbers of animals that used to live in North America. So that, say, in the 1600s, when people first came over, when, you know, Anglos first came over, and Europeans, it's just incredible to read about what they found. You know, you could, there's salmon so thick in the rivers that you could walk across the rivers, literally, and, you know, lobsters that were 6 feet long. Just this tremendous abundance of wildlife. And that was still true in a lot of places, certainly in the Midwest, in, say, the early 1800s, as late as the early 1800s. And it was inconceivable to people that they could shoot. You know, we're very critical now that people sort of shot out all the wildlife, you know, through the fur trade and the wildlife markets and all that. But we have to remember just how abundant the wildlife was, and that for a long time it was really inconceivable to people that it was possible to really make a dent in this wildlife, and it really took the, you know, extinction after extinction, and And near extinction after near extinction, a lot of wildlife species, especially game species, went nearly extinct in the mid-1800s.
Mm-hmm.
It really took that before people realized that, oh, my God, you know, we have to do something about this.
Well, you also, I mean, this notion that Native Americans were all, you know, lived in harmony with nature and didn't exploit it and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that that's not quite accurate. I mean, there's, at the same time that the European settlers or the Americans, as they were just defining themselves at that point, were acting out the American story of harvesting this wonderful abundance, mm-hmm. The Native Americans were doing the same thing, perhaps in a slightly different way.
They were. That's always a problematic thing to say that Native Americans were living in harmony with nature, partly because it assumes that Native Americans aren't still around. But, yes, I mean, Native Americans were also going out. Actually, I talk about one group of Native Americans, the Senecas, which were particularly dependent on pigeons. They lived in what's now Pennsylvania and upstate New York. And what they did was they were sort of hunter-gatherer tribe, and they used to actually find the pigeons every year and go so that they would have sort of pigeon years every year. And what happened was the groups would generally split up most of the year, but they would send out runners in, I guess they would come in the spring, they would go to nesting. So they would send out runners in kind of early spring to find where the pigeons were, and then all the Seneca groups from sort of all over this two-state area would converge, and they would, again, have this enormous festival, and it was the time when, you know, pigeon time was the time when the groups of Senecas would get together and sort of make tribal decisions and have marriages and weddings. It was this very important time for them. Now, I have to say the difference is, as much as I'm leery of pointing to Native Americans as models, which I think is done far too often, because they actually do alter the environment quite radically in many cases, there was one really significant difference, which is that they only took young pigeons out of the nests during nesting season. Now, this is really critical because, as you can imagine, they're not taking adults. They're not taking, you know, the nesting adult population. They're also, you know, a much smaller population of people who are using the pigeons, and those two things, I think, combine to have them be a serious threat.
Sure. Well, you also say that it's not that, you know, they had this connection, long-standing connection that was sort of goes back probably hundreds of years with these flocks of pigeons. And it's not that the white settlers didn't have those ties with the pigeons and with nature in general, but ultimately the colonists' ties to the pigeons were expendable.
Yeah, exactly. The Senecas really depended on pigeons. They would be in trouble, you know, if the pigeons weren't around, because there was a block of time during the year that was pigeon time, and it was sort of between, I think, maple syrup harvest and deer season, and that's what they relied on. And they would also pack the pigeons away and dry them and use them through the year. Now, the colonists loved pigeons. They loved pigeon pie, and the early cookbooks are full of recipes, pigeon recipes. And I love it because in the recipes for pigeon pie, they always say, you know, in order to say, so that you know what kind of pie it is, you should take two pigeon feet and put them upside down in the center of the pie, which was not happening at Delmonico's, needless to say,
right,
in the pigeon dishes. But at the same time, the pigeons are expendable. You know, they're basically relying on crops and animals that they have brought from Europe. And that's, you know, occasionally those crops and will fail, like from a drought, and you hear about times, you can read about times when pigeons sort of saved the day. You know, they saved, say, thousands of people in this one region of Vermont from starving after a drought. But by and large, they were expendable. So as much as people loved pigeons and they loved this kind of festival time, it was, you know, they could do without it. And I think that's another big difference, that wildlife is expendable to the Europeans who come over. And I think that, you know, contributes to why they don't sort of take measures earlier.
Along with the development of the market economy, which happened in, you know, throughout the existing states around mid-late 19th century, you note a major change in the meaning of pigeons, that it began to be centered on money. And this wasn't simply greed, per se, as much as a natural consequence of people trying to survive in what became a market economy. And the actual bird and its meaning had become more abstract. It was simply another way to get cash to trade for necessities, commodified, so to speak. But at the same time, it lost its pigeonness. I love that.
Yeah, well, what happens is exactly it. I mean, you just described it, is that with the rise of the market economy, the farmers, who have always been the people who are shooting pigeons since, say, the 1600s, the Europeans, they become pulled into the market economy, almost everybody, you know, as the rail lines reach different farming communities. And so they're no longer, they're shooting pigeons for themselves, but they're also shooting pigeons for market. And so now what happens is not only do all the local farmers converge on the pigeon nestings or the pigeon roosts, but you have market hunters from all over the country converging, and they're hiring local farmers to help them. And so the pigeon becomes important not just as a pigeon, as something that you're going to put in pigeon pie or you're going to use the feathers to put in a pillow, but it becomes important as money. And, yeah, that's a level of abstraction that's new and that's interesting because anything can be money. You know, basically the pigeon becomes the same thing as corn or a hog or a quart of milk, which are the other things that farmers are selling to get money. And I think that's kind of a step of abstraction in which the pigeon comes to mean something that's more disconnected from the kind of specifics of a pigeon, or as you said, I say, it kind of loses some of its pigeonness. And then, of course, when you get to the cities and people are doing two things with them, they're eating them in fancy restaurants, and they're also using them for trap shooting. If you think of the term, if you've heard of the term clay pigeon, which is what trap shooters use now, which is a clay disc that people shoot at for a target, that term got its provenance because they used to use real pigeons. And they would shoot, you know, at real pigeons as targets. So they're doing those two things. And in a lot of ways, both eating at a wealthy restaurant and shooting a pigeon at a trap shoot, which is done by mostly sort of upper-class and middle-class men, urban men, those are very meaningful activities. They're also kind of festival and party times, but they really don't have that much to do with pigeons. And so there's kind of a level of abstraction that happens with our connections to nature that I think the pigeon story is especially good for talking about.
Yeah. Well, you document these trap shoots, and not only did they shoot wild pigeons, they shot them by the thousands or the tens of thousands or perhaps more. And it became part of an essential act of manhood, or is sort of, you know, people talked about it as eliciting coolness and character and masculinity, and it became a statement of who men were or should be.
Right. Men would converge. Trap shoot was, its real heyday of trap shooting was exactly in about 1870 and 1880. Not coincidentally, I think exactly. And the decade when after the rail lines reach the Midwest and they're shipping them to the East for a decade before the population crashes. And what happens is these men are sort of going from New York out to the country to, say, sporting clubs, and they're having these trap shoots, these competitions. And it's really interesting to read the sporting papers of those times, and they'll say, and there'll be ads in there from Midwestern dealers, like Chicago dealers, saying, you know, I have pigeons and I can... you know, I have pigeons on hand and I can send them. And then you see reports of tournaments that happen, and they say, well, we ordered, you know, $30,000 pigeons from this guy in Chicago. So they're sending pigeons to Chicago in the tens, from Chicago to New York and Boston in the tens of thousands. And these men are really, if you read the sporting manuals about hunting, they have these, you know, it's still true, they have these very... they have these codes about hunting and what hunting means to them and what shooting means to them. And they're all about manhood and all about sort of how to be a man. And it takes character to be able to shoot well, and it takes sort of coolness and determination. It's all about kind of how to be a man in the late 19th century, when there's a lot of anxiety, actually, about how to be a man exactly at this time in the late 19th century, especially how to be a white upper-class or middle-class man, because it's a time of very heavy immigration. And it's also the end of the frontier, and people are very anxious about that. So all these kind of anxieties focus around this trap shoot, and you can almost sort of smell manhood in the air when they're shooting pigeons. And again, these events are very, very important to these men. They're very meaningful, but they really have almost nothing to do with the pigeons themselves, and the men don't necessarily know anything about the pigeons that they're drawing into these sort of meaningful events. Again, a very, very moment that you can see people becoming modern in the ways that they connect to nature.
Yeah. Well, and then as the pigeons died out, which nobody could believe would actually ever happen since there were so many of them, people started blaming each other for the demise. If the pigeons were disappearing, it had to have been the field hunters, and it became actually, instead of being about a battle about conservation, it was pretty much a class war.
It is a class war. They pretty much, well, especially from the sport hunters, who say, look at these people, these market hunters. They're shooting all these birds. They're doing it for money. They're not shooting birds in the right way. You know, it's like real men don't shoot birds for money. And so that's the way that a lot of urban men sort of describe the extinction, as they say, you know, it's these lower class men who did it, and it's because they don't have character. So in a lot of ways, the extinction for them still becomes this kind of story about how to be a man. But more generally, what happens is that they blame the hunters, and hardly anybody blames the consumers. A few people point fingers at the trap shooters, especially because it's hard to ignore people who are, you know, shooting 30,000 birds in one day. But by and large, they blame the hunters, and nobody blames the people who in fancy restaurants like Delmonico's who are shooting them. You know, no one says, you really shouldn't have been ordering those ballotines of pigeons a la Madison, which is one of the pigeon dishes that they're serving. So no one's blaming, you know, Mark Twain and Ulysses S. Grant and the governor of New York and all these people who are eating at Delmonico's frequently. And again, that's very, very, very modern, is to kind of ignore the ways in which we consume nature.
Let's talk with the listener in Urbana, line number one. Good morning, you're on Focus 580.
Good morning. I'd like to know if your guest feels that the same attitudes that contributed to passenger pigeon destruction are still in play with regard to whole habitat destruction in the 20th century, coming into the 21st, for a whole variety of reasons, residential development or logging, either one. Or especially with development in wetland areas along the coast, which turns out to be pretty risky with the hurricanes. And I'll listen to what you think.
Sure, I live in a place where we've basically destroyed the wetlands too in Los Angeles. Sure, I think, you know, like I said, this is a moment where you can see people becoming modern in the late 19th century. And what happens essentially is, I think, people lose track of the ways that they use and transform nature, and we don't think of nature in the cities or the places where we build houses as being nature. I think this is a real problem, but I think the solution to this problem is not necessarily... I mean, I think that environmentalism has focused for a very long time on habitat preservation, endangered species, wilderness preservation, and it's just in the last 10 years really turned to focus on urban issues, and I think this is really the right turn of events, because I think we don't, you know, it's not that we just have to preserve habitat and not build houses on places. We have to learn how to build houses well, and we have to learn how to use nature well. And I think the problem with the emphasis on preservation has been that we're not thinking about consumption and we're not thinking about using nature, so that all forms of using nature become somehow destroying nature. And it's not a very useful way to think, because we have to use nature. So just to go back to the Volvo commercial that we started with, which is the idea that nature out there, this sort of gorgeous, beautiful, uninhabited place that we haven't yet destroyed yet, is going to save your soul. In the course of writing this book, I decided, you know, I don't think that's what's going to save our soul. Nature out there is not going to save our souls, no matter how often we go to it. What's going to save our souls is learning how to use nature well, and that work's going to take place inside the cities. Does that answer your question?
No. My idea was that many of the attitudes of the people that both hunted and consumed passenger pigeons are still in play today. And I'm thinking of the Intermountain Western states and the attitudes toward development that another author, Todd Wilkinson, described in his book Science Under Siege.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you're familiar with that, but he was interviewed on WILL some time back, and I was quite taken with his ideas and his book.
I don't know his book, but I do know that there's certainly a lot of voices in environmentalism saying that we have to, you know, put the brakes on development and think about habitat preservation, and I think that's really true. Obviously, I'm not going to argue with that, and I think that the problem is attitudes toward nature. That's part of the problem.
Well, with your attitudes, are you moving toward the directions, for instance, that would result in the, to use nature, about sunlight, solar-powered suburbs and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think that what we really need to think about is how to use nature sustainably. And I think it's going to be really hard to think of, to do things like habitat preservation well and effectively unless we really deal with sustainable consumption. And that involves exactly things like solar power. It involves things like redesigning cities to be more nature friendly. It involves what I think is probably the thorniest question of all that I deal with head on in a chapter, particularly on the Nature Company in my book, which is how much nature we're consuming. And I think that's the hardest question of all to address, because it's really a question that asks people to really examine their own lives and the ways that they consume nature in their own lives, not to mention all the people who make a tremendous amount of money out of selling us things that are made out of nature. So that's, in some ways, I think the trickiest question of all.
Yeah, that's a wonderful chapter. And just to put a point on that, and then we'll go on to another caller, you know, it seems to me the real moral, especially in that chapter and really throughout the book, as you put it, to use resources more sustainably, first you have to recognize you are using them. Mm-hmm. And all these levels of abstraction, whether it's the fine diners at Delmonico's devouring, you know, pigeons by the millions or whatever, or the rest of us when we buy, inflatable plastic whales at the Nature Company, we might, the abstraction is such that we think that this inflatable plastic whale is almost a statement of our environmentalism, when in fact it's made out of petroleum.
Yeah, I think the Nature Company is a wonderfully ironic place, and I say wonderfully because I think it's a great place to think about how we connect to nature. In a lot of ways, the Nature Company, I think this is true about TV too, and all the nature images that come through to us on TV, it's a much more effective place in a way for thinking about how we connect to nature than when you go out to these gorgeous places, you know, that I love and many of us love, like Yosemite, or my favorite place is probably the San Juan Mountains in southwestern Colorado. And that's because the Nature Company is a place where you can think about what nature means to us, but you can also think about how we consume nature, and you can think about them at once and together. So what the Nature Company does is, you know, Jack, what you said is exactly right. I think that they sell things like, say, a plastic whale from Glacier Bay, and that's supposed to mean certain things like this beautiful place, and it's quiet, and it's tranquil, and it's wild. But what we don't think about is that the plastic whale is made out of nature. It's made out of oil, which might even come from reserves that are very close to places where real whales live. So there's an irony that's going on at the Nature Company that I think is really useful to look at, which is that we sort of make nature mean this place that's out there and that's somehow different from our everyday lives. But at the same time, we're, you know, the Nature Company, like every place in the mall, is a monument to the consumption of nature.
We have a couple more people waiting to talk. Let's include them. Next up, line number two, listener in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was very interested. I'm very interested in your book and your talk. I really think that we're on the subject of Native American influences as part of the range of human influences. I don't think we're getting anything like balanced popular accounts of Native American influences on the environment. And there are two examples that I'd think of. One is problematic, but that by about 10,000 years ago, the megafauna of the Ice Age have disappeared off the North American continent. And there's plenty of evidence that Native Americans or Siberian hunters who'd followed these animals into America and became Native Americans were the ones who were hunting them. And these are animals, hairy elephants and things like that, the mammoths, the mastodons, that had survived a number of warm interglacial intervals like this one. And the second instance I think of is that before there was much European-American penetration of the continent west of the Appalachians and south of the Great Lakes, by the late 1600s, the Indians have, or the Native Americans, have become fur traders. Mm-hmm. And with enormous influence on populations of beaver, which are terribly, terribly important to wetland development and production, maintenance, and a lot of the high-order carnivores like mink and sable and so on. I really think the book hasn't been written, but I think there's a lot of information out there now that human presence in the last 5, 10, 15,000 years ago, maybe longer, with our terribly, terribly capable ways of adapting and hunting mm-hmm. and gathering has had an enormous influence. We may be wandering in this thing we call wildness in many areas. We may be wandering around in human gardens.
Yeah, and I would just, I mean, I think that's exactly right. And there are, I don't know if there's one book that pulls it all together, but there certainly has been a lot of work, just say, in the last decade about the ways in which Native Americans transform the environment. The one I would add to that, the one incident I would add to that is fire. There's a lot of evidence now that, in fact, the prairies were maintained by Indian fire. And that Native Americans throughout the continent, certainly North America, very intentionally altered their environment using fire, you know, created an open understory so that they could hunt and would have travel corridors, things like that. And that sometimes these fires got out of hand also. I think there's a couple of good reasons for talking about that. And one is that I think it's unfair often to Native, we often tend to treat Native Americans, like I mentioned before, as if somehow they died out or they ceased to become real Indians once they became involved and caught up with Anglo and, you know, with European markets or Euro-American markets. And I think that's really unfair, so that we tend to judge Native Americans now as if somehow they should be behaving like they were 200 years ago. So it's a very dangerous thing to do, I think, for Native American communities now and the kinds of decisions that they have to make. But the other thing is that the one place where I might depart from what you just said is I'm not sure I would take this lesson as being, and I'm not sure this is what you're saying, but there is a tendency to say, well, look, humans were always a blight on the continent. And I think that's not necessarily true. What I would say is that, you know, humans have always made mistakes. They've always been able to make this big impact on the environment, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we were always a blight on the environment or that we have to be. And I think that we really have to think of ourselves as, we really have to sort of get past this guilt complex about the ways that we use and transform nature, because I think to live on Earth is to use and transform nature. So the question is not whether to do that, but how to do that and how much to do that.
I hope that gets to the caller's question. I do want to move on to our next caller, and we'll go to someone in Champaign on line number one next. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Thanks a lot for being on this. I'm really enjoying the program. And I just wanted to contribute one thing about some thoughts I've had about trying to put these kinds of ideas into words. And I just wanted to, one thing that I thought of was just that reality really exists in the natural and wilderness areas. That's really where you see real reality. And what we experience as the buildings and the cultural things that we experience every day are sort of like a fiction written by humans. Just wanted to contribute that. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Well, what do you think about that? Are buildings real, or is nature real, or what's, you know?
Well, I have to say, the danger of being sort of stoned, that we tend to think of nature as being the real world. And again, I think that's a little bit dangerous and sometimes not very helpful, because it kind of gives us the license, I think, to not think about the places where we live, which most of us live in cities, as the real world. You know, again, it's this idea that that real nature is sort of out there, and that's kind of the real world before we came along and destroyed things. And if you think that way, on the one hand, it's sort of true in many ways, obviously. You know, we've hardly treated the environment sustainably. I live in Los Angeles. I can look around and tell you that very easily. On the other hand, it really handicaps us. I think it really ties our hands, because if you think of cities as places where nature has been completely destroyed, it's really hard to think about the nature that really is in cities and how to do nature better in cities. I'm going to give you an example just from where I live, which is Los Angeles. There's a place called the Los Angeles River, most degraded river in the country. It's been completely encased in concrete. It's a big joke nationally. You don't even know it's a river. You know, when people come to Los Angeles and go over, it's just a sort of, looks like a sewer system, and it's treated like a sewer system. On the other hand, if you go down to that river, there are places where the bird life is incredibly abundant. It's a very hopeful place in a lot of ways, but if you just assume that this is a place where nature no longer inhabits, it's really hard to think about how we're going to fix that river. You know, it becomes, I think, almost just way too overwhelming. And I think, you know, the way we're going to fix cities is sort of one piece of nature at a time, and it's really hard to think about how to do that if we just say, well, there's no nature left here. It's not really a real landscape anymore.
Well, these are pretty deep issues to try to pick apart. I think it's, you know, returning to the chapter on the Nature Company, that again struck a chord with me, because you describe your reaction. It's almost a cognitive dissonance or something. I'm not sure that's the way to describe it. But, you know, you walk in there and, you know, I had the same experience. I was at the mall, Union Station in St. Louis, and walked into my first Nature Company, and my reaction was, as you describe, wow. But it was a kind of a scratch the head wow. It wasn't just, wow, this is, you know, nirvana. It was more like, wow, I feel really strange here. I mean, it's a cool store, and it's got all these nature products with a natural N, but I'm not sure what to think of this.
Yes, I think that's true, and most people will say that. If you know, you ask them what their first reaction to a nature company was, it's kind of, oh my goodness. And they're pulled in, you know, look at everything. But at the same time, when I would ask people what they thought about the nature company, they would say, you know, sort of person after person would say, oh, I don't know about that place. That place really kind of creeps me out, or, you know, that place is really fake. But then they would, if you push them, they would tell you all the things that they've bought there.
Right.
So, and that was certainly described to me. So I was curious about that. And I think what the Nature Company does is very interesting, like we were talking before, is that they market this idea. Almost everything on the shelves speaks to this idea of nature as being this place of great beauty and wonder and reality that's kind of out there and that's going to kind of save us from modern life, or that's a counterweight to all we know that is so crazy in modern life. But at the same time, one of the things that's craziest about modern life is modern consumerism and the crazy pace of modern consumerism and just how much we consume and how ecologically destructive it is. So there, like you said, there's a dissonance in the place. One of the things I try to do in the chapter is to say, look, we tend to say that the problem is the Nature Company, that they're doing this hypocritical thing, but I think we have to look at ourselves. We do exactly what the Nature Company does and asks us to do, which is that we idealize nature as this place out there that's apart from consumerism and it's apart from cities and traffic and noise and crazy work lives. But at the same time, we consume nature intensively. That's exactly what the Nature Company is about. But I think we tend to kind of look at the Nature Company and say, and I don't trust this place. But I think we need to look at ourselves and say, well, what am I doing?
The thing that, it's so interesting because there is that feeling of discomfort, you know, that you don't trust the place, but it's got this nature theme. It's almost like you're encouraged to consume, to preserve nature, as you put it. It's an you're told that you're sort of an anti-consumer. So what it does is it pushes those contradictions that exist in every aspect of our consumer lives right to the surface, where we kind of get a little glimpse of them, and that, you know, that implicates me. You know.
I think that's right. Yeah, that's exactly what makes us uncomfortable. Is that, I mean, you could be on top of a mountain in the San Juan Mountains, you know, in southwestern Colorado, a very remote place. They think there might still be grizzlies there, you know, very remote place. And you're still a person who idealizes nature as a place out there, but also consumes a lot of nature, but it's really hard to think about that. At the Nature Company, it's almost hard not to think about that. There's a contradiction there, and you're right, there are places in American culture where this contradiction kind of pops to the surface, almost like the volcanoes, you know, potential volcanoes in American culture. That's one of those places. Another place is, I think, television ads, television commercials, like especially commercials for, say, sport utility vehicles, where, again, it's, you know, they make us really uncomfortable, but at the same time, a lot of the people whom these commercials make really uncomfortable own sport utility vehicles. And so, you know, again, we do exactly what these commercials ask us to do, even though they make us uncomfortable, and we think the problem is the commercial, but we sort of see nature as this gorgeous place that's going to, you know, like the Volvo commercial says, save your soul, or like the Ford Explorer commercial says, where the pavement ends, the world begins. You know, this idea that the real world is out there. But at the same time, we use, in this world, we use nature in very, very real ways and very, very, very abundantly as consumers in things like sport utility vehicles. So just like you said, it's a place where that contradiction kind of pushes to the surface and it becomes a little bit easier to think about, which is one of the reasons why I wrote a book about nature, a kind of nature writing book or a kind of Thoreauvian book in which I go to the mall, because I think there are really interesting places for thinking about how we connect to nature. And we ought to be going to the mall a little bit more, I think, actually, and thinking about them. Almost all nature writing people go out to the mountains. You know, they go kayaking down rivers. They maybe hang out on a farm. But they don't really think about what happens in the places where most of us live, which is cities. There's very little urban nature writing, and I hope that will change.
Mm. We just have a minute left, and I just to kind of finalize this discussion, well, you know, we've only scratched the surface, really, but you say something I think that's really great, that's really right to the point. In terms of nature as a place apart, the power of that lies not in nature itself, but in the boundary it draws between nature and non-nature. It's that boundary that allows us to have all we want.
Right. I think what happens is that, yeah, exactly. We say out there is nature and in here is artifice. And what that allows us to do, I mean, I think it's a very powerful idea for a lot of reasons, but ultimately it's very convenient because what it allows us to do is to not recognize the ways that we use nature in our everyday lives. So it kind of assigns, you know, the meaning of nature is out there and the uses of nature are in here, and we keep those separate, and it allows us to do things like drive sport utility vehicles without thinking about how that sport utility vehicle is actually made out of nature.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, and we've scratched the surface, as so often is the case on this show. But for those of you who would like to read more, certainly look for the book Flight Maps, Adventures with Nature in Modern America. It's got a big pink flamingo on the cover, and it's recently published by Basic Books. Delightful reading, so you know, I think you'd enjoy it. And the author has been our guest, Jennifer Price.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it.
Me too.